This is Sustainable Long Island. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On Long Island's East End, schools, hospitals, and other public services rely on a workforce that can't afford to live where people work. Rents can easily reach $6,000 or more per month for a two-bedroom house, and that's just for the 9 months of the off-season. Year-round housing is even more difficult to find. With summer housing out of reach to anyone except the wealthy, year-round workers find themselves without housing just when rents are the least affordable. As a result, the daily so-called trade parade of workers driving in from the West adds hours to long commutes, and people have been quitting their jobs in droves. Teachers, healthcare workers, firefighters, police, shop clerks, local government staff, and more. Help wanted signs are everywhere, with fewer workers willing to brave the commute or able to afford the rents. On November 8th, voters will decide on legislation that would allow the towns of East Hampton, Southampton, Shelter Island, and Southold to each establish a community housing fund, funded by a 0.5% real estate transfer tax. Last year, state legislation authorizing the fund was signed into law by Governor Kathy Hochul. The bill was sponsored by State Assembly Member Fred Thiel Jr. and his counterpart in the state Senate, Anthony Palumbo. The legislation mandated that towns would have to first adopt a community housing plan and a local law establishing the fund. That's already happened. But a final step remains, a referendum by the voters to approve the legislation. That's on the back of the ballot, November 8th. This week, I spoke with Sean McLean, managing partner of the development firm Impact Collective, about his experience with affordable housing development in the town of Southampton, New York. The firm is focused on addressing development with a commitment to social, economic, and environmental sustainability. Impact Collective is working with the village of Sag Harbor on similar plans for affordable housing, plans that approval of the referendum will make much easier. Sean McLean, welcome to Sustainable Long Island.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be on the show this morning.
We're talking to you about prospects for affordable housing development on the East End, but we're also talking about, I really want to start a little bit further back than that, to talk about the Impact Collective, which is a company that you are managing partner for. Tell us what the Impact Collective is and its purpose.
So our main business is partnering with municipalities to help them realize their development, economic, social, and environmental goals for the long-term planning. So whether we're actually partners with them or advisory to them, we help understand what the goal of the leadership, the staff, as well as significant community engagement in order to help them craft programs and local laws and policies that help them reach those goals.
So what is the idea behind it, or how did this get started? Because this is a private company, and it sounds like an unusual one.
It is a private company. It is an unusual one, and we take pride in that. So we are a for-profit developer of real estate, and we work with municipalities that have underdeveloped or underrealized potential in land and community. So in doing that, we can realize market rate profits and still promote the greenest and most socially responsible real estate development possible. And so it becomes a real interesting partnership between the municipality and the community and the developer, and creates a team rather than putting people at odds. And we find that to be much more rewarding and humbling to work with the community towards making an economic return for our investors while we have non-monetary returns of substantial interest to the community and to the municipality.
So often profit-making and community needs are opposed to each other. So talk a little bit about what your model is for convening stakeholders, people from the community and the business community, the government, et cetera. How do you work out what can often be competing interests?
Well, we start with no goals. So we sit down with the community and the staff and leadership within that municipality, and we work with them for months to try and understand the goals of the community. And then as we're doing that, we work to understand what the market opportunity is. So we're not a multifamily builder or a hotel builder or an office builder. We want to invest in what the market wants to invest in and do it with the community's understanding and buy-in and contribution. So everybody at the end of the day is getting what they need in order to make something happen. The goal is to leave the once a project is built, that the community itself is better off socially and environmentally than it was with nothing happening.
So let's talk about affordable housing then. The profit-making model is to build, here on the East End, is to build as enormous as possible single-family houses and sell them for multiple millions of dollars, which is why it is so difficult. I went to the dermatologist the other day, and I had to wait an extra hour to be seen. And I asked, politely, I asked why. It was my first visit to this doctor, and I wanted to know if this is what I'm always going to expect. And I was told that they'd lost their physician assistant because she lived up island. She can't afford to live in East Hampton or in anywhere here on the East End. And it was just too much of a commute for her. Now, she's just one example of many examples. We really cannot staff the people we need in order to have the kind of community we have. So talk about this private-public partnership with affordable housing. How do you make money? Whose needs are primary? Whose needs are centered? Because they can't always come out equal at the end.
Sure. Well, I appreciate that story because my children go to Our Lady of the Hamptons, and we had seven teachers leave between last June and this September, and two grades don't have a Spanish teacher. So the crisis on the East End as a sustainable place is here. It's here, and it's affecting the lives of all of us that live here full time and our children. So I certainly appreciate where you're coming from. And the profit versus community conversation is a hard one because the system is set up to fix that. If you're doing tax credit housing to create the affordability, the state process is meant to even the playing field with the luxury market. So they will pay the right price through the tax credit system to allow the developments to happen. The issue is that zoning on the East End is designed to keep the density of affordable housing from being approved. So you can have a 9-bedroom, 14,000 square foot house, but you couldn't have 24 affordable housing rental units on the same property. And that is a bigger issue than the ability for developers to make a profit and invest in the affordable housing on the East End.
Wow. Yes. We've been talking for a long time here, people who are interested in affordable housing and also in environmentally sound housing, we've been talking about this very same issue. You can't do cluster housing here. We've got many, many village downtowns that have, could have the possibility of apartments over the shops. But then we always run into problems with wastewater systems and sewage and things of that kind. So talk a little bit about the work of your company, either on Long Island or other places in New York, to tackle those issues.
So in the hamlet of Riverside, in the town of Southampton, we've been working with the town for years. In our process, often we will use our proprietary form-based zoning overlay system with a customized seeker system that's really robust and more creative than any other seeker process in New York.
And what's seeker?
Oh, sorry. So the state environmental quality review is the state mandated environmental review of any sort of zoning or significant development. And that's what municipalities use to regulate entitlements and what can be built and all of the environmental and social regulations that can be put into that new zoning. So whether it's traffic or stormwater or sewage or school children, there's a spider web of studies that go into understanding what the impacts of zoning and development can be. So we create these very flexible zoning codes that have very strict and robust environmental and social regulations to them. And in Riverside, we worked with the town board to go through a process of putting into place a zoning code that will allow a very significant mixed-use workforce-based development zone that has a huge amount of environmental qualities to it. So heat island reduction requirements, water use reduction requirements, LEED ND equivalency, nitrogen-dependent landscape elimination, stormwater collection and recharge. And the biggest thing is that it would create a sewer district that would pick up and treat all of the existing septic systems, removing 20,000 pounds of nitrogen a year from the direct entry to the Peconic Estuary, with the goal of making sure that the environment is better after all of this housing and these shops and you know, area is built out than it is today in the existing environment. Now, of course, we were also able to put into a lot of social investment. The area has a number of significant issues that we only learn about by engaging with the community. You know, there are dark sides, even in the Hamptons, of communities that have been disinvested and taken advantage of by bad actors. And Riverside is one of those. And in working with the community and groups like SEPA Mujer for Latina leadership programs, we've come to understand some of the problems in the communities where we can charge fees to developers to go directly towards organizations that are fighting those place-based issues. And that's at the core of what we do, is understand the place-based economics, the place-based issues, environmentally and socially, and share the development profits in a way that makes sense to fix those things.
Well, that sounds pretty impressive. Talk a little bit about the numbers and also how you can measure the impact, because this is a part of your work is to make sure that, you know, it isn't all nice and pretty on paper, but you can actually measure what you've done.
Sure. The social side is harder to measure. That's always the thing that we struggle with. And we also often struggle with people wanting to measure quantity versus quality. So we do it on a person-by-person basis from the social impact side. On the environmental impact side, we do use the standard metrics of greenhouse gas emissions reduction, carbon sink technology, wastewater runoff reduction. We can measure the heat island reduction. We can measure the amount of sewage that's been treated, so the nitrogen and phosphorus that's going into the groundwater and surface waters can be measured through those systems. And so we can really understand the impact that takes on.
This is Sustainable Long Island. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Sean McLean, managing partner of the development firm Impact Collective, about the prospects for affordable housing on Eastern Long Island. So one of the things when I looked at the website for Impact Collective, you talked about new urbanism. I understand that as kind of walkable, mixed-use communities. Talk about what you're doing to develop those kinds of communities on Long Island or in New York in general.
Sure. I'd like to say first, so when we say new urbanism, we're really talking about an ethos of place-based clustered development that has multiple uses, right? That's walkable, that has easy access to transit, and reduces the need for people to continue to travel long, long miles to get to work, to get to restaurants, to get to goods and services that they require, and allows people to live within that environment in order to reduce, you know, car travel, car miles traveled, et cetera, et cetera. So it's clustering those uses. Now in New Rochelle, they want a skyline. They want 28-story buildings. They want to be a major urban center with significant growth, but it's not the, you know, that's not appropriate for Wainscott, right? So the place-based urbanity is very important. Urbanity does not mean Manhattan. It does not mean New Rochelle. It means the proper environmentally responsible and cost-effective clustering of multiple uses within proximity, right? And that way, we can treat the environment better. We can preserve more. We can spend a lot less on the infrastructure required to promote that type of development, which is often the killer of these things, is the amount of infrastructure of areas that are so spread out that you have more disruption of roads and sewer pipes and potable water pipes and gas mains. And you don't need that for everybody. And not everybody prefers it. Not everybody wants to live on 2 or 5 acres in the middle of a large development that everybody has 2 to 5 acres. And certainly most people can't afford that, right? So we use that in order to cluster the development. With the cluster development, we use less land, and using less land and lower infrastructure costs, we can make things more affordable naturally through building those places up. And whether it's 3 stories or 30 stories is simply a matter of place.
That's fascinating. So is that what you're doing in Riverside as well? Is that part of the project or?
Yes. So Riverside has an as-of-right approval for up to 3 million square feet, 2,300 residential units, 50% on a one-for-one built basis must be workforce housing. It could be all workforce housing, but it can't be all market rate. So it has to be at least 50-50. And most of it has requirements to have storefronts, and it's all regulating the public realm, the sidewalks, how the buildings front the sidewalks, the architecture, all of the environmental, all of that is completely regulated into the zoning code. So if you choose to use it, you're choosing to regulate your buildings into this collective good and understanding. And nobody can use it unless they're tying into the public new sewer treatment plant, which is still being worked on by the town to try and implement. But it can't be used unless it's all of the systems, the environmental and social systems, must be in place before anybody can use it.
So you do the development. You don't have to depend on other real estate companies. I mean, basically, you're the one who is driving this. Is that correct?
So we drive all of the underlying rules and regulations in working with the community. And then once we set up the rules and regulations, we control a certain amount of property, but anybody is allowed to come in and develop. So all of the properties in that area have the right to opt in. The homeowners or business owners who want to use it or want to sell their properties have the right to do so. And other developers have the right to come in and build. In New Rochelle, we did the same thing as in Riverside. And there are 17 different developers that came in and built over the last 5 years since we put it all into place. And there are more coming. We don't want to be the only one in town. We like the idea that we've opened up the gates for other developers and other investors, because the more differentiated groups that invest, the better and larger the organic growth and more likelihood of success of the area is. And so the whole community, the whole new development, shares in the costs of the infrastructure and the fair share mitigation of the environment and the social issues within the place.
So let's talk about the Affordable Housing Initiative. This is on the ballot in on the East End here. And by the way, I want to tell our listeners who are in New York that there is another very, very important measure on the ballot as well, and that is the Environmental Bond Act. You have to flip your ballot over in order to vote on them. But this Affordable Housing Act, tell us about how this would or make your work easier, if it would.
Well, it certainly is a funding source, particularly for the infrastructure needed throughout the East End to allow density to happen. All right, so that even if everybody wanted it to happen, even if there was nobody that was against density and affordable housing in the right places, right, there'd still be a cost factor that might be insurmountable to develop the way it needs to be developed. Then this funding source could go a long way to helping that happen. It's also a source of income for the individual zoning authorities, right? So the towns and the villages, to have a resource of money to do the zoning and the state environmental regulations and entitlement themselves. So they set the game board for anybody who wants to develop, right? They set up the rules, they set up the regulations, they work with the community, and it becomes something that is self-built and offered to investors. It's not the other way around, where investors come and demand what they want, and then there's a struggle between the community and the government, and then there's a perception of ill will or lack of transparency or these dead air and misinformation and all of these things that happen in the traditional way that that real estate is developed. It kind of flips it on its head. It gives the people and the electorate and the elected officials the ability to do these robust studies and take it into their own hands and then offer it out to developers to come in and build according to the rules that have been set ahead of time.
So finally, I'm going to ask maybe a difficult question, which is, a lot of people say development itself is bad, that we can't afford to have more people out here. Of course, we said at the beginning that when we don't have the, you know, we don't have the right kind of people here, that we need to have an actual community, the firefighters, the physician's assistants, the teachers, then the community fails. But how do you grapple with the issue of population density and environmental integrity?
The technology to better the environment is upon us. We have it now, right? So the environment it can be protected. It can actually be bettered. We can actually fix what's wrong out here by building. And that's what I think a lot of people don't understand, is that the only way to pay for significant environmental improvement from today is to either generate taxes to pay for it, right, or build and share the burden with development in the right places to fix the underlying environmental issues that we have. I mean, the house I'm in right now, we made, you know, we're drinking coffee one morning. I'm like, the coffee tastes salty. I have saltwater intrusion in my well. I can't drink the water coming out of my faucet, even with a filter on it. The problems out here are here. They've already been caused. So we have to figure out a way to fix it. We have long-term planning. That's the environmental side. So I believe the technology is here. The systems are here. We can do it right now if we had the capital to pay for it as a community. And we better find that capital some way, right? On the other side of this is the social side of it. The schools are dwindling. The after school offerings are non-existent. The sports programs are going down the tubes. Our well-rounded children and the reasons we chose 10 or 20 years ago to raise our children out here, those systems, those reasons, and the community character is disappearing. And I, you know, our parents are still answering EMS calls. So when the 65-year-old or 70-year-old volunteer fireman or woman is the one going on the EMS call or going to fight the fire, and we don't have enough young people to replace these critical services, the highway departments, the police departments, the teachers, I mean, they're not service providers. Those are community committed people, right? That is the heart of the community. But we can't afford not to do this. And we can't afford anymore to have a rhetoric that these people don't belong here. And if you move into that place, you'll be already pegged with a stigma of lack of belonging and lack of importance, and people that feel they don't want you here. You don't join the community when you live in a place that has been so fought over violently and pegged with stigmas that are so self-damaging in your self-worth because you live there. That's not fair to the people that would live in these places. And so from that dialogue needs to happen, because we have just as many people, but they're not volunteering. They're not working in the schools. They're not being accountable to the community, to the neighbors. I mean, I lived on Shelter Island for 8 years in my 20s and early 30s, and you recognize the accountability to your neighbors when you're on that island full time for 8 years, right? That you learn that if you didn't know it when you got there. The whole of the East End is losing that, and it's a shame because it's what makes it special.
Wow. We have to leave there, but that's a very powerful place to go. And of course, well, I want to thank you, Sean McLean, so much for talking with us. And, you know, I think we'd like to call you up and talk to you a bit again about maybe some of your work on climate action plans that you've done. But we don't have time for that today because we're really talking before the November 8th election and that all-important proposition on the ballot for affordable housing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
This is Francesca Rhiannon with Sustainable Long Island. We talked with Sean McLean, managing partner of Impact Collective. Information about the firm is online at mpactcollective, all one word, .com. Information about the Community Housing Fund legislation can be found at eastendbeacon.com. Sustainable Long Island is heard on the third Wednesday of each month at this time, and also on the second Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. Programs are online at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com, where you can also find those links we mentioned. Sustainable Long Island is produced by Tony Ernst and me, Francesca Rhiannon.